much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
Welcome back. As America prepares to mark its 250th birthday, there's no better time to revisit the people, ideas, triumphs, and contradictions that have shaped this nation. For this special edition of Book Picks, part of our series, We Still Hold These Truths, America at 250, we're joined by Mike Hare of Northshire Bookstore. Mike has assembled a thoughtful selection of books that explore America's founding, its evolution, and the many voices that have defined its story. Whether you're a lifelong history enthusiast or simply looking for a deeper understanding of the country's past, we have recommendations that offer fresh perspectives on the American experience, and it's a great pleasure, as always, to welcome our friend Mike Hare to the program. How are you, Mike?
Very well, Joe, and thank you for inviting me for this special occasion.
When I was thinking of this, I said, this will only work if I can get Mike to do it, and so here you are, and I'm thrilled that you took us up on the invitation. We're gonna look at a fairly wide range of American history.
Yeah, the first book I selected, Joe, is not America 250, but America 362. It goes back to 1664, and the book is Taking Manhattan by Russell Shorto. Many of our listeners are familiar with The Island in the Center of the World, which Shorto wrote about 20 years ago, which is sort of an overview of New Amsterdam from the time of the arrival of the Dutch until 1664. And Taking Manhattan is a much more concentrated book about the English takeover of New Amsterdam at that time. Peter Stuyvesant was in charge of New Amsterdam at that point. He had the peg leg. He had an irascible personality. He's very well known, certainly to our listeners. And the British naval power was just ascendant at that time. They were becoming the predominant force on the seas, opposed to the Spanish and the Dutch, who had been for many, many years. And the British King Charles II decided that New Amsterdam was in his sights and he wanted to take it over. He sent Captain Richard Nichols and a fleet of British ships to New Amsterdam to take the city over. And what does that mean? You fire the guns, you go on a rampage, and you make the New Amsterdam folks surrender. Stuyvesant was in a very tricky position because he was dedicated to New Amsterdam. He was the administrator of what was basically a mercantile colony. And he had a choice to make. And the choice, do you fight or do you surrender? And unlike many other confrontations in world history, he surrendered. It worked out well for the British. Certainly they moved in. It worked out just as well, really, for the Dutch because they could keep much of their culture. And New York City is a melting pot. New Amsterdam and then New York City is the melting pot of the country and even of the world, you could say, at that point. And today was sort of based on the New Amsterdam experience with the Dutch and then when the English came in 1664. But it's a wonderfully insightful book about what could have gone wrong, but in this case did not go wrong, thanks to some foresight of the leaders.
A great historian and a great New York historian.
Yes.
Russell Shorto and Taking Manhattan.
Next book is The Cause by Joseph Ellis. This came out about 10 years ago. And what Ellis does, and there's so many books written about the Revolutionary War, and this is a fine one, and he basically, in one volume, summarizes the Revolutionary War from 1773 to 1783. The cause was the phrase that the colonists used in their revolt against the British. And what Ellis does very effectively is show the different sides on the both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. He talks about the revolutionaries, John Adams, Sam Adams, Thomas Jefferson, the armies of George Washington. He also talks about the loyalists who wanted to remain British subjects. There are many people on the fence. He also juxtaposes that with what was going on in England, Lord Germain, King George III. Many Americans at that time thought that the king would be their friend and Parliament was their enemy. And as it turned out, well, they were both their enemies. And he goes back and forth. He cuts back and forth between the two countries, between the two cultures, and shows that the American Revolution was not something that was set in stone in terms of when the battles were fought at the beginning. Many thought that the British would overpower the Americans. Certainly that did not happen. But Ellis goes into great detail about the diplomacy, about the battle strategies, and about the attitudes of the people on both sides of the Atlantic. And we all know how it occurred, how it ended.
Absolutely. The book is The Cause by Joseph Ellis. And a local guy as well.
So yes, that's right. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Next.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, Team of Rivals. And this came out about 20 years ago, and Doris Kearns Goodwin is certainly well known to all of our listeners. Team of Rivals deals with Abraham Lincoln and his early days in the presidency and throughout his presidency, actually. And the rivals deal with his cabinet, in particular William Seward and Salmon Chase. And they were rivals for the Republican nomination in 1860. They had kind of ill will toward Lincoln to a point anyway. Seward especially thought he deserved the nomination in 1860. He did not get it. And what Lincoln did very effectively was meld the beliefs of folks that did not necessarily agree with him at all times to form his administration. There was a lot of dissent. There was controversy, as there isn't any administration. But what Lincoln was adept at doing was to channel some of the criticism, some of the disputes that were going on within the North at the time, and try to fuse a situation where there could be kind of a sense of unity and a sense of purpose in winning the Civil War. Not every president agrees with having people that are not on your page in the administration, but Lincoln, in a sense, did. And Team of Rivals was actually the Spielberg movie that came out, Lincoln, in 2005 or 2006, was based largely on this book. It's a hefty book. Maybe it's her best-known book, but Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals is worth reading for anyone that's interested in policy, intrigue, the Civil War, and American history.
It is, she's the absolute best at doing this, and I think this is one of her finest books.
Yeah.
Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin. Next up, another terrific historian.
Eric Larson, Deadwake. Eric Larson is extremely popular. He wrote Devil in the White City. His most recent book, in fact, is The Demon of Unrest, which is about the Fort Sumter and what went on there. And we're kind of going in chronological order here. Deadwake is about the sinking of the Lusitania, which happened in May of 1915, 3 years after the Titanic sunk. And the Lusitania was another of the unsinkable ocean liners. And, of course, it did not make it all the way to Liverpool. Larson goes into detail about the mistakes that were made on board the ship. He also goes into great, very interesting detail about what it was like in the submarines, what the Germans were doing and what they could see. And it was a very claustrophobic kind of a feeling as you were reading the book and seeing that and understanding to a point what the Germans were trying to do to protect their own interests. 1915 was still 2 years before America entered World War I. Wilson was the president. He ran for re-election in 1916. His slogan was, he kept us out of war. Of course, that didn't persist much after that election. But Deadwake is one of Larson's best books, too, I think, because it goes into detail about a pivotal event which began to kind of turn the tide figuratively and literally about the American attitude toward Germans, toward Germany, toward what was going on in Europe. And the isolationist spirit began to waver just maybe a little bit after that occurred.
The name of the book, Deadwake, by Eric Larson.
The next book is, if you look at lists of the top books of the 21st century, the first quarter of the 21st century, this one almost always appears, and deservedly so. It's called The Warmth of Other Suns, and the author is Isabel Wilkerson. And this book is, in a broad sense, about the Great Migration. And the Great Migration occurred roughly from the early days of the 20th century, say 1915, until about 1970. And what it consisted of was the mass of people, African-American people, who were living in the Jim Crow South in Alabama and Mississippi and Arkansas and states where voting rights were not really something that they could count on, where property rights were things that they could not count on as well. And what they wanted to do and what they did in droves was head up north. They headed up to the urban centers of the Northeast and even out west to look for a better life. The term The Warmth of Other Suns comes from a poem written by Richard Wright, who was one of the great 20th century authors. He wrote a wonderful haiku at the end of his life that a lot of people don't know about. And he was also the author of Black Boy and a very, very prominent African-American author during the mid-20th century when the Great Migration was happening. And what Wilkerson does is just kind of extraordinary because she manages to describe this huge event of millions of people going from the South to the North by focusing on three individuals. One was a man who lived on the Atlantic coast of Florida, and he was worked for the trains, and he was going up and down as a porter on the Pullman cars of the trains, and just helping passengers on and off. And what he had to do every time he was on the train was kind of change roles when he crossed the Mason-Dixon line going in either direction. The seating arrangements would change, the boarding arrangements would change, and this was well into the 20th century. So there were two different cultures, which is why the Great Migration happened to begin with, because the folks in the South wanted to get away from the restrictions of the cultures in their neighborhoods to go to the North. So he was one of the characters. The second character was a woman, a sharecropper from Alabama, who resettled up in Chicago. Very interesting, very vibrant woman, and lived a very long life in Chicago, and her story is just fascinating. And the third story is equally fascinating. It's about a man in New Orleans, and rather than going north, he went out west to Los Angeles and became a very successful doctor in L.A. by 1950 or so. So what Wilkerson does is she talks about these three people, but as you're reading about these three people, you get a sense of what was happening not just to them, you certainly do with them, but you also get a sense of what was happening all through the country at that time. Very lyrical writer, just like a first-class novelist, her style, but it's all factual. And through the book, Joe, I don't think there's a single graph or a table or a statistic. Not that there's anything wrong with those sorts of things, but sometimes it can detract from the story. And she tells the story so lyrically and so eloquently and so with such knowledge and passion that you really feel like that this is, you know, you kind of know these people by the end. She spent years writing it, and she was able to interview these three folks before they passed away. So it's very legitimate in terms of what they said. They're direct quotes from those folks' story. It's just a great, great book.
The Warmth of Other Suns. I love that you use the word lyrical, because it's a beautifully written volume.
Gorgeous. And you know, it's a tough subject.
Yes.
But the way she writes it, it's beautiful. It's
really
a beautiful book.
Good stuff. Yeah. The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson.
Reaganland by Rick Perlstein is my next selection. I can never remember if this book is 914 pages or 916 pages. It's a tome. It's
What's
a big
two
book.
Pages
What's two pages?
Friends?
What's 2 pages? Yeah, but it reads like a 780 page book. It really does. It just speeds right along. It's anyway, but it's a little bit. The title is intentional on Perlstein's part. I also wrote Nixonland before Reaganland came out, but it's not about Reagan's presidency. Rather, it's about the Carter years. It's about the years specifically from 1976 to 1980 when Carter was president. And just to back up a little, Ford became president after Nixon resigned. Ford was never elected president or vice president. So when he ran for election in 1976, he was not running for re-election because he had never been elected to begin with, except for as a congressman in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So Reagan challenged Ford in 76, and he came very, very close to wresting the nomination from Ford. It was a very tight race. It went to the convention in Kansas City, and Ford barely snuck by. Then Carter was the Democratic nominee. He was favored. He had a 27-point lead over Ford in the polls at some point at the beginning of the campaign, and Ford nearly beat Carter. Carter got 50.1% of the vote in 1976. So it was extremely close race. And then Reagan was 65 at the time, I think 65. And in that day and age, 65, we were over the hill. That's certainly not the case today. But people thought, well, Reagan's too old, he'll never run again. And of course, he did. And what Perlstein focuses on was the country during the Carter years. And you have to think back in that point of time, those of us that can remember it, can remember the stagflation that was happening. There was inflation and there was unemployment at the same time. Carter, for all his great deeds afterward, was really not an inspirational president. Perhaps he was very low-key and it was very kind of told things in a very realistic way and did not really inspire an awful lot of passion with a lot of folks in the country. And then we had the Iranian hostage crisis toward the end of his term. So the United States was going through a very difficult time. Crime was at a very high rate at that point, too. The crime rate had increased through the 60s and 70s. Howard Cosell in the World Series of 1977 when the Yankees were playing, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Bronx is burning." And so, yeah, that kind of a culture going on at the time. So it was a very dissatisfied culture with much of America. And what Perlstein does is he talks about this. He talks about what was going on. He talks about what Reagan was doing behind the scenes, because, again, people didn't think he'd try again. And if he did, he'd be too old. And of course, that's all been disproven clearly when he was elected in 1980. But he talks about the inner workings of the Republican Party. He talks about the NRA becoming a much more viable political aggressive force at the time. He talks about the anti-abortion movement, which aligned itself with the Republicans. He talks about the moral majority in Jerry Falwell in the sense that America had lost its moral bearings at that time. So all of these undercurrents were going on in the late 70s while Carter was president. And what Reagan did very skillfully with his communication skills and his ability to relate to people was capitalize on that. He won the nomination, became president, and then Pearlstein does draw. He doesn't do this overtly, but there is certainly a thread, or more than a thread, from 1980 to where we are today, politically, socially, economically, however you want to name it. And it kind of began when Jimmy Carter was in the White House in 1976, and what transpired then percolated under the surface until it burst into full form. And it's a wonderful book. It is long, but it's I believe, very much worth reading.
It is Reaganland by Rick Pearlstein, and as Mike mentioned, also the author of Nixonland. And they were books about 10 years apart.
I think so, yeah.
So I assume we're coming up on something soon.
Another one, we can guess who might be next, maybe.
Well, I think we could probably can guess that. Again, the name of the book is Reaganland by Rick Pearlstein.
And the final book I have, Joe, is sort of a summary of American history, and there are many of those, too, and many, many fine books, but John Meacham is yet another. There are so many wonderful authors. We didn't even talk about Rick Atkinson, Candace Millard, Hampton Sides, are just great historians that are out writing today, and I hope people avail themselves and read as many books by these folks as they can. But John Meacham, a lot of bios from George H.W. Bush and Jefferson and Jackson. But The Soul of America is about America in troubled times and how we got through these troubled times, and some of the obvious places where he would emphasize the troubles would be the Civil War. He talks a lot about Joe McCarthy and McCarthyism and what was happening in the 1950s, but he also talks about times that are maybe not publicized as much in American history. And one of those times, which we didn't really dwell on with the warmth of other suns, but Reconstruction before that. And Reconstruction, of course, began after the Civil War and in 1865. Andrew Johnson was not a proponent of Reconstruction. Ulysses Grant was. However, Reconstruction met with a huge blowback in the southern states, and the Jim Crow culture kind of began at that point, the Lost Cause culture of the South was also born at that time, daughters of the Confederacy, groups like that, and the Ku Klux Klan, of course, in the 1870s was starting to form as well. So you had this blowback and pushback against Reconstruction, and Meacham goes on to how that basically fell apart. Plessy versus Ferguson came out with Separate But Equal in the late 1890s, and so then you had, again, this everything is interrelated, and this kind of led into what happened with we're talking about with the warmth of other suns and the Great Migration in the early 20th century. But that's one of the points in Meacham's book, is how we got through the Jim Crow era. He also talks about the threat of fascism early in Roosevelt's term, which a lot of people maybe did not realize. The Ku Klux Klan made a great revival in the 1920s, maybe not a great revival, but they made a disturbing revival in Indiana, of all places, in the 1920s. So they were around in the 20th century. And he talks also about the Vietnam War and the repercussions of that. So Meacham, in his book, is able to distill some of the difficult situations that America, the country, has been through. And when we're going through these times, a lot of folks might have the idea we've never been through this before and it's never been this bad, and maybe we haven't been through what we're going through at any time before. Everything is new. But is it really new in terms of going through problems, whatever you're doing in your life personally and certainly with the country too? And it's sort of learning from history, which is kind of a cliche thing, but it's true. But it's also putting things in perspective. You think things are the way they are, but then you take a step back and see how things were 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and it's not the distant past, because it's human nature, it's culture, it's politics, it's society, everything kind of interwoven together. And Meacham, in a very clear-sighted way, is able to make the case that, okay, we can get through this again.
You lead a American history reading group.
I do, yeah.
So there, mm-hmm. you get together with
the great people.
People that are really interested.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. They're a very smart group. I learn from them all the time. It's different ages. Some people come in, they think it's going to be an all male, or it's very gender based. I think it's about 50-50, which is very nice too. And outspoken people and people that are, it's just great. It's a lot of fun.
That is terrific. And again, it is Mike Hare is here from North Shire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York, where he is the manager of that store. North Shire also has a location in Manchester Center, Vermont. You can find out more information by going to their website, which is northshire.com.